So I had this experience a couple of years ago where both my phone signal and the power went out at the same time at my place. And this, of course, killed the fridge buzz and the music, which left me in silence. And for about the first 5 minutes or so, I just sat there and I enjoyed the silence. It was really nice. But then something happened that I found to be a little unsettling. I got up and I started pacing around the apartment and I checked my phone, even though I already knew there was no signal, because, that's what we do now because we're addicted to these things. And I remember, for some reason, standing in front of the fridge, like it was gonna offer me something useful, like it was gonna give me answers. Anyway, so then my mind started to get a little loud, and old memories started surfacing, regrets and things of that sort. I guess you could say it became a fairly comprehensive highlight reel of awkward moments that I'd apparently been suppressing with background noise and distraction for who knows how long. Questions that I usually keep sedated under things like podcasts and audiobooks started floating up like they'd been waiting for exactly this moment. And then I had this thought, standing there in the silence, that maybe modern life, it's not designed to actually help us live. It's just designed to help us avoid being alone with ourselves long enough to notice that something feels off. I would add deeply off. Because the thing is, the moment that that the machinery went off, I didn't feel peaceful or restored. I mean, I did feel a little bit of that. Yes, but mostly I would say that I felt vulnerable. Like something had been discreetly removed that I hadn't realized that I depended on quite that heavily. And I think that's the part that's worthy of some analysis here. Which brings us to a Norwegian philosopher by the name of Peter Vesalzeva, who had this idea that I find both, I would say, fascinating and deeply unsettling. So his idea, or his argument, was that human consciousness is essentially, well, it essentially overshot the runway, and that we became aware enough to examine existence and time and death and meaning, all of it, without developing the psychological equipment to peacefully live with those realizations. So, in other words, the brain got a little too carried away at certain things, and now we're just stuck with the consequences. Great. Now, other animals typically experience pain and fear, but then when the threat passes, they typically just go back to being or doing what they were doing before. I mean, a rabbit that narrowly escapes a coyote isn't spending the next 3 weeks processing the experience in therapy, right? It just goes back to being a rabbit. Which isn't to say that animals aren't deep and sophisticated in their own ways. They just don't share our particular burden of awareness, our unique human condition. Because for us, we can ruminate on suffering that hasn't even happened yet, right? I mean, we have this ability to remember suffering that's years behind us. And, you know, we can construct completely abstract suffering out of things that exist only in our imagination. And at pretty much any moment, we can be aware that all of this ends in death, and we don't even know when that's going to happen, but we know it's going to. That is a lot to carry around as a human being, while also trying to do things like, stupid things like answer emails or some other banal chore. So, Zappa thought humans developed basically four strategies to cope with all this. Different ways of, I guess, managing the excess awareness so it doesn't become completely debilitating. And what I find interesting is that if you look at these strategies, you can pretty much see that all, you know, you can see all of modern life in them. Okay, so there's the approach where you just, you don't look at certain things, right? You ignorance is bliss. And then there's the building of routines and identities that are ideally, they're solid enough to stand on when the ground feels unreliable. Then there's also the use of distraction to fill the silence with anything that's available. And of course, distraction is a massive one these days. And then, I guess, of course, there is the introspective approach of where you're taking like the unbearable parts of existence and discussing them on social media or wherever. And voila, here we are. I think the root of all of this and what Zappa was really trying to say is that the human condition or the human, well, the human relationship with consciousness it's always been complicated. I mean, we didn't arrive here well equipped for what awareness actually involves. So we've been trying to deal with this by improvising various coping strategies ever since. So in a sense, the power outage just, I guess it just temporarily removed a few of the more recent ones. So, all right, let's talk about distraction for a second, because I do think there's, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I think there's a different way to look at that. So distraction gets treated like a character flaw, right? Like if you just had a little more discipline and willpower and, you know, more of whatever self-help is currently selling, you'd be able to just sit with yourself comfortably, and then everything would be fine. But the problem is that framing misses something important about what distraction actually is and what it's doing for people. Because the thing is, the phone, it isn't just entertainment. It's also something like portable escape infrastructure. So the phone, it gives you the ability to not be wherever you are mentally at any given moment. Whether you're waiting for a bus or sitting in a waiting room, or you're lying awake at 2 a.m. with thoughts that you'd rather not be having, or sitting on the toilet. I mean, the phone it solves all of these by simply just replacing the experience with a different one. And I find this to be kind of eye-opening, because I've noticed that the moments where we reach for the phone with the most urgency are usually the moments with the lowest stimulation. Like, you know, when you're in the elevator or waiting for the 30 seconds between putting something in the microwave and it getting done. Silence has become this thing now where it needs to be immediately filled, like you have a hole in the wall that's letting cold air in. David Foster Wallace wrote about this, the way default consciousness just ordinary unmediated consciousness or awareness, I guess, and how it can feel genuinely uncomfortable to people. And I think he was right. And I also think the situation has gotten, I would say, significantly worse in the 20 years since he was writing about this. Because we've developed this thing now where attention, it's almost never singular. So you've got the podcast running while you take a walk. You've got a video playing while you eat. There's of course music usually playing in the background. You've got 25 tabs open, you know. And it's not that any of these things are insufficient on their own. It's more that the silence underneath them has become difficult to be in. Now, I wouldn't call this weakness, though. I think what's happening is closer to what Zappa was describing. So consciousness, when it's left entirely to its own devices, without some kind of anchor or distraction, or I guess any forward motion of any kind, what happens is it starts asking questions that don't have comfortable answers. And the phone, well, that just happens to be the most convenient answer to the problem that's ever been invented. And that I see as both a massive achievement and a catastrophic one. And it makes for a complicated problem. All right, so I have noticed that there's a particular type of person who's like always busy. And I don't mean not necessarily productive busy, but they're perpetually scheduled. they're always behind on something. They're constantly in the middle of something that cannot, it absolutely cannot wait. And I've noticed that when these people do finally get some, like a free moment, they don't relax. They get uncomfortable with that. And they find something to fill it within about 4 minutes, or fill it with. Eric Fromm was writing about this sort of thing around 70 years ago. This idea that genuine freedom actually produces anxiety for a lot of people. So this issue's been around a while. It's just that these days it's like on steroids. So Fromm said that when you remove the structure and the obligations and the identity that comes from being needed somewhere, what's left is just you. Alone with your own consciousness. And for a lot of people, that turns out to be much less relaxing than is advertised. So the busyness becomes like a kind of solution. It becomes a socially rewarded form of not being present to your own life. And I think the genius of it, if you want to call it that, is that it comes with a very convincing cover story. You're not avoiding yourself. You're being productive. You're ambitious. You're making something of your life. And the fact that it also conveniently prevents any sustained self-examination, well, that's just a coincidence. Heidegger called this falling into everydayness. So we have this tendency to lose ourselves in routines and the role until we come to this point where the actual texture of your own existence, it just kind of dissolves into the background, which of course sounds bleak. And it is bleak, but it's also, I think, it's just the operating mode of a significant percentage of the working population on any given day. And then there's the entertainment side of this, which is it's its own thing. So Guy Debord, writing about this in 1967, which again seems both impressive and unsettling. So he argued that modern society was replacing lived experience with representations of experience. And he wrote about how people were becoming spectators of their own lives rather than participants in their lives. I think about this in relation to the way people now, there's a lot of observing and watching going on. Like, for example, travel videos instead of actually traveling, or watching relationship content instead of actual, investing in actual relationships. Which that's a level of recursive avoidance that probably would have made Debord feel vindicated and also physically ill. Then there's also the sunset thing, where the experience of a genuinely beautiful moment now just gets partially processed as a lighting opportunity. I think it was Marshall McLuhan who coined the phrase, the medium is the message. And the medium now is a 6-inch screen that fits in your pocket and is with you pretty much 24/7, including apparently during sunsets. Make of that what you will. So not all escape is the same thing. And I think that's an important distinction to make before this monologue accidentally implies that every form of checking out is equivalent. Because humans have been altering their consciousness for as long as there's been consciousness to alter. Every civilization, every culture, every era, whether it's, it could be alcohol, psychedelics, ritual, erratic dance, gambling, meditation, fasting, and so forth. So the specific method varies, obviously, but the impulse underneath it is remarkably consistent. Aldous Huxley had this idea while writing about his own experience with mescaline in the 1950s, that ordinary waking consciousness might actually just be a kind of filter, and that the brain's default mode, it isn't to perceive everything, it's actually to reduce everything down to what's actually useful for survival. He also said that certain substances or practices temporarily open that filter much wider, which I guess you could see as either profound or, a very sophisticated justification for what people were going to do anyway. And I think Carl Jung was circling something similar when he wrote about the unconscious and the collective unconscious. So this idea that parts of experience we don't consciously process, those don't just disappear. They accumulate, and then they find other ways out eventually, one way or the other. And some of what gets labeled as escapism might actually just be the psyche. It's trying to access something that's been cut off. Like an underground route back to something that got sealed off somewhere at some point. Now, I think that the interesting distinction, and I find myself returning to this, is between escape and avoidance. And escape as expansion. I mean, numbing yourself to get through the week is one thing, but absorbing like a moving piece of music that somehow feels life-altering, that's something else. Now, both are technically escapes from ordinary consciousness, but they leave you in different places. Now, one, I think, just makes you smaller. The other occasionally makes you feel like you briefly understood something that you can't quite hold on to once it's gone. And I feel like most people have experienced both of these things at points of their lives. And most people know the difference when they feel it, even if they don't or can't really effectively articulate it. The question is just, which one are you reaching for and why, and whether you're being honest with yourself about the answer. And it's and that's that is an uncomfortable question. So naturally we tend to not linger on it too long. So I want to talk about something that I think reveals more about the human need for escape than almost anything else these days, more than almost anything else these days. And that's the apocalypse fantasy. I did a video about this last year. And I don't mean only people who are, you know, vocal believers that civilization is ending. I'm referring also to the much larger numbers of people these days who are more discreetly holding the fantasy, which is basically, in a nutshell, what if everything just stopped? And the infrastructure collapses, and the power grid goes down, the internet dies, and suddenly all the invisible obligations and performance metrics and the algorithmic identities just disappeared. You know, maybe this is why zombie films and shows have been a very reliable genre for decades. And it's probably not because people find shuffling undead particularly compelling as a narrative device. I think it's because hidden inside the whole collapse scenario is something that feels, if you're being honest, a little like relief. Because in the collapse fantasy, the emails disappear, the carefully maintained professional identity disappears, nobody's optimizing their morning routine or building their platform or anxiously checking their engagement metrics or whatever, or working a bullshit job, or dealing with any of the other extensive corruption that's happening in our world and our society that I don't even need to go into, goes without saying. You know, all you're doing at that point is you're just, you know, once the apocalypse has happened, and if you survive it, you're just trying to find food and not get eaten, which is pretty terrible, obviously. But it also brings clarity. It brings it in a way that modern life, with all its complexity and performance, usually isn't. Sometimes I think half the population wants societal collapse purely so nobody has to answer Slack messages anymore or have meetings. And I say that only partly as a joke. And you know, the thing is, look, it's not really about emails or Slack messages. It's about how these trivial things reveal the underlying crushing sense of meaninglessness and absurdity you know, the absurdity of existence. And this is how these, it just seems like these mundane, insignificant things are how we're spending our very short lives. It just makes it very apparent. Eugene Thacker writes about this pull toward the impersonal and this fascination that we seem to have with forces and systems that are, they're so large that, you know, they render human concerns, our petty human concerns, as meaningless by comparison. And I think there's something in that which explains the doom scrolling too. You know, this compulsive consumption of disaster content. It isn't purely masochism. I think there's something almost soothing about scale and about massive, ubiquitous problems that temporarily dissolve the smaller and the more personal ones, which is its own kind of escape. It's just a rather, I guess, darker flavored one. And I think what all of this busyness and this distraction is really pointing at, like all the entertainment and the apocalypse fantasy stuff, I think it's telling us that modern life has become genuinely and structurally exhausting in ways that go beyond just being tired. Something underneath it is asking, begging for relief. And we're just reaching for whatever's available. All right, so back to the power outage again, where all this started. So yeah, eventually it came back on, and along with the fridge hum, and the phone signal returned, and immediately it delivered 17 notifications that had apparently been waiting impatiently for that exact moment. But, you know, honestly, part of me felt relieved because, I felt relieved, but that's the part that I keep thinking about, because I had maybe 40 minutes of genuine peace and quiet. 40 minutes of just being in a room without anything mediating the experience. And it was interesting, I'd say, for about the first 20 minutes or so. And then it got rather uncomfortable for the rest of it. Now, this was a few years ago, and I've since made some changes. You know, the mind, when it's left without any input, it doesn't idle peacefully. It rummages, and it asks questions that it already knows you don't have answers to. And I think Zappa was right that humans, you know, we developed these coping strategies for a reason. Because consciousness is heavy. There's a lot of weight in being aware of time passing and obviously mortality. There's a heaviness in the divide between the life that you're living and the life that you vaguely imagined. And that's not something that most people can sit with indefinitely. And, you know, maybe they shouldn't have to. Just something to consider. Now, the question that I keep coming back to, and I don't have a clean answer here, is whether the escapes that we've built are actually in some way helping us metabolize existence or just postponing it. I mean, are we using distraction to rest and return, or just to avoid arriving somewhere uncomfortable that might actually be worth visiting? Because I think some escapes genuinely do something, like, you know, great art, like a film or some music that leaves you seeing your life differently afterward. Or maybe it was just a conversation, an amazing conversation that went somewhere you didn't expect it to go. Whatever the case, I think maybe the difference is that real escape, it doesn't remove you from life, it returns you to it. Just slightly altered somehow. And then, of course, on the other hand, some escapes just keep you numb and moving, where you're present enough to keep showing up, but you're absent enough to not have to feel too much of it. And I think most people know the difference. They just don't always choose based on that knowledge, which is human and understandable. And also, if Zappa is right, it's probably inevitable to some degree. So, yeah. So the power came back. And the strange thing is, within the first few minutes, or I guess within a few minutes, or whatever that was, 5 or 10 minutes, I couldn't quite access the feeling that I'd had during the silence, because it was already fading, like, you know, the way dreams fade after you wake up. Something had been briefly visible, and then the lights came back on, and it was gone. But I think that was the moment for me where I decided to start doing that on purpose in the future. And it's been helpful to just shut it all off sometimes and sit in the silence where you get to learn how to survive your own thoughts. All right, I think that's it for today. Thank you so much for listening.